This is Murder in the Black with Steph and MD.
Welcome back to Murder in the Black. It is your host, Steph. I hope that you guys enjoyed last week's case, the listener's suggestion. So if you are particularly passionate about a case that you've heard before and you want to have it told here on Murder in the Black for our audience, make sure you slide into our DMs either on Facebook or on Instagram, and we will be sure to tell your story before the end of season 6. Now, we are going to go ahead and get into our cold case theme for today. And I don't want to pretend that we all know about cold cases, because maybe you're new to true crime and you're not particularly fond, or you may not know about what a cold case is. So I'm going to give you a working definition about what cold cases are before we get into our true crime case for today. Now, cold cases are unsolved mysteries that continue to intrigue and challenge investigators, often spanning years or even decades. These cases represent unresolved crimes, missing persons, and mysterious events that have evaded justice and closure for victims and the communities that the victims are in. And this particular crime case today is one that I have not heard of. And so when I ran across it, I watched a documentary, read several articles for today's crime case, and I just know that this is a story that does not get the notoriety that it deserves. And if you're a true crime sleuth like me, maybe you have not heard about it, but it is definitely a story that should be told in the Black community. But more so than that, it is a crime that should be told in American society. So buckle up, buttercup. We're about to get into a true crime case that you should know about. Grab your coffee if it's the morning. Grab your lemonade if it's the afternoon. But for sure, if it's the evening, most certainly grab your wine, because we're about to get into our true crime case for today. Our true crime case takes place in Griffin, Georgia, and you probably haven't heard of Griffin, Georgia. It is a small town right outside of Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta, Georgia is about 35 miles away from Griffin, Georgia. But to be honest, in my research about Griffin, Georgia, it is a middle ground to a lot of major cities. Birmingham, Alabama is 148 miles away from Griffin, Georgia. Charlotte, North Carolina is 240 miles away. Nashville, Tennessee is 249 miles away. Jacksonville, Florida is 252 miles away. You're catching my heavy drift. Do you understand where I'm going with this? Griffin, Georgia is a hub to a lot of major cities. But Timothy Coggins' niece, who was young back in the early 1980s, when this true crime case takes place, really gives us a really good perspective on Griffin, Georgia back in the early 80s. She tells us that Griffin, Georgia was a beautiful place to grow up in. And it was not unlikely to see a Confederate flag growing up in Griffin, Georgia. I mean, let's face it. Griffin, Georgia was in the Deep South. It was in Georgia. And although hearing this, you may scratch your head and be talking back to your cell phone. I was about to say your radio, but your cell phone or maybe your iPad, and saying, Steph, like a Confederate flag. But the truth of the matter is that was normal in Griffin, Georgia. You would see a Confederate flag flying in the wind on your way to school or on your way home, or maybe even your neighbor had one in their backyard. It was normal to see that growing up in Griffin, Georgia. It was also normal to see the race line there in Griffin, Georgia. Black people stayed on one track, and on the other side of the track, white people stayed. And they rarely intermingle, but they were friendly with one another. And that's just how it was in Griffin, Georgia. So that kind of gives you a setting of how it was in the early 1980s. On October 7th, 1983, 23-year-old Timothy Coggins wanted to go out and have a nice time. And so he and his sister Talisa decided they wanted to go out for a night on the town, wanted to let their hair down, so to speak. And because Griffin, Georgia had color lines, well, the clubs that they went to also had color lines. And so they decided to go to a club called the People's Choice Club. And this was a club that Timothy Coggins frequented often. And it was a predominantly black club. And you know how it is when you go out to your favorite club, you're excited to go. And the atmosphere was just right on October 7th. It wasn't that many people. And People's Club Choice, or People's Club, was a small place. You could fit probably comfortably 100 people inside the club. And Timothy always loved going there, but you know how it is with your favorite spot. Like, you didn't want too many people at your favorite spot because then you didn't want to be there. But on this particular night, it wasn't a whole lot of people there. So when Timothy and his sister Talisa arrive at the club, it's not a lot of people there. And to know Timothy is to know that he absolutely loved to shake his tail feather on the dance floor. So he makes a beeline to the dance floor, and his sister Talisa taps him on the shoulder and says, "Hey, I'm just gonna go use the restroom. I'll be right back." And so he just says, "Okay," and he goes out to the dance floor, and Talisa runs to the bathroom. Well, within 5 to 10 minutes, Talisa comes back out to the dance floor, and her eyes are ping-ponging through the crowd. Now, it's not that crowded, but you know how it is when you're looking for somebody. Your eyes are just kind of going back and forth between the heads on the dance floor and between the bar, and she can't quite place where Timothy is. But as she's looking through the crowd, several people come up to her. And they're telling her that Timothy was dancing with a white girl on the dance floor. Now, I've already kind of told you the culture of Griffin at that time. And to see a white girl in People's Choice Club was a little off-putting, but it was not uncommon for some white girls to come in the club from time to time just to have a good time and party. But for a black man to dance with said white girl, well, that was a totally different thing in its entirety because it was taboo. It was taboo for a black guy to dance with a white girl in Griffin, which the race barrier and the lines would hardly ever cross, let alone dance with one another. So when she hears this, she starts to get a little nervous and she's actively still looking for her brother. And these people are still talking to her as she's kind of still trying to filter her way through the crowd, still looking for her brother. And then another person comes over and says to her, "Well, yeah, Timothy actually left the club because two white men were inside this club looking for him. And so he actually left the club with two white guys who were looking for him in the club. And he's left. He's not even here anymore." So when she hears this, she starts to get nervous and her heart starts beating fast because she's not able to figure out what this exactly means. Did he leave free of will? Is he okay? He's dancing with this white girl. What does all this mean? This happened all within a matter of minutes of her just quickly going to the bathroom and coming back. Now she can't find her brother. So she just walks to the front of the building and exits. And at this point, she doesn't see her brother. She doesn't see these two white men. She doesn't even see this said white girl that he was dancing with. So she just decides that Timothy more than likely is okay. Timothy can look out for himself. He usually always does. And so she assumes the best and she has a good time that night. And she ends up leaving the People's Choice Club early that morning. She arrives back at home, which is her mother's house where Timothy is also staying. And Timothy's not there on the morning of October 8th at around 4 a.m. when she arrives home. But that's not unusual because sometimes Timothy doesn't come home for about 2 to 3 days. And so she doesn't think anything of it. As I've already said, she assumes the best and expects to see Timothy within a couple of days. Timothy Coggins was a dancer. He was full of life and energy. And actually, that's what led him outside on October 7th, 1983. He actually went to the People's Choice Club to dance and just have a good time. He was an entertainer. But more importantly than that, just some of the traits about his personality is that he was a fun-loving person. And according to his niece, she loved her uncle. And he was the fun uncle. Like, and he was young when she was young. And I think that always makes a uncle or an aunt particularly even more fun in your mind when you're younger, is because they can keep up with you, they can have fun and entertain you, and that's exactly what Tim was for his niece. But according to Tim's cousin, Tim was hit by a car when he was younger and Tim almost died. And because he almost died, he got really, really close to his mother, and this caused his family, but particularly his mother, to give him a lot of attention. And so he got really close to his mother even after making a full recovery. He was the same happy, fun-loving Tim that he always was after making a full recovery. Now, at the age of 23 years old, Tim didn't have a career at the time. He was still trying to figure life out. But the one thing his cousin and family said about him is that Tim was a hustler. If you gave Tim an opportunity to get something done or to, you know, have a job or whatever it was, Tim would make that opportunity work for him. He was a hustler and he would do everything that he could in order to make things work in his favor. And that's just, or those were just some of the things about his personality that made him special in the eyes of his family. Although he was at People's Choice Club to dance and to have fun on that particular night, he would also go to the club to help out the owner and to do a couple of odd jobs for the owner because, as I said, he was a hustler. And so he was given the opportunity to get some money from the owner to do odd jobs and things like that, so he would. But on October 9th, 1983, this is 2 days after Timothy had not shown back up at home, still in the Coggins residence, they didn't think that anything was wrong with Timothy. But the Spalding County got a 911 phone call, and the person who received that 911 call from the dispatcher was a patrol officer by the name of Oscar Jordan. And Oscar Jordan got a phone call saying that in the northern part of the county there in Griffin, Georgia, that a man was found in a big field near the hanging tree. And this man was lying face down, and they believe that the man was deceased. And so as a patrol officer, Oscar Jordan immediately goes out to investigate. And so he arrives on scene along with first responders and the detectives at the time, along with the sheriff of Spalding County, to see what indeed was there at Hanging Tree. Hunters came across a black man's body close to the tree. The man's body had been stabbed repeatedly. He had a pair of pants and underwear on only. Both of those garments had been pulled down below the victim's thighs. And Oscar Jordan described this scene as the grossest sight he had ever seen. The victim was totally disfigured. He could not be recognized and did not have any ID on him. The victim had been dragged from the roadway to the field. There were tire marks. There was a sweater that was pulled inside out, and it appeared that it or the victim had been chained to the back of a truck, and the truck drug the victim first around in a square pattern, and there were sites of blood at each corner of that square on the road. There was a 6-inch circle of blood 2 inches deep down in the ground near the roadway, and they believed that the victim was told to get out of the car and that he was then struck over the top of the head with a club. There was a stab mark at the victim's knee, and that they believe that he was cut at his tendon so that he was unable to run or get away or flee from the field. The detectives then collected evidence, and the evidence that they collected was a whiskey bottle, a wooden table leg. They believe that wooden table leg was used to beat the victim over the top of the head. They collected electrical tape. And the sheriff who was on site or at the crime scene was Sheriff Butch Freeman. And at this particular time, he pulled Oscar Jordan to the side, and he told Oscar Jordan that he was temporarily going to put him in charge of investigating this crime to see if he could, one, ID who the victim was. And this was primarily done because there was a lot of tension between the white and black community. I mean, the racial line was already drawn in Griffin, period. We know that because it was a segregated town. Since Oscar was black and the police department was primarily white, the sheriff knew the writings on the wall. He knew that more than likely this looked and it appeared to be a hate crime. That's what it appeared to be. And he knew that he needed to have a black cop on this case. Now, it is unclear through this documentary and the articles that I read if Oscar Jordan had any prior investigative work or tenure in as a detective. We don't really know. But we know that the sheriff put him in charge to ease the racial tension. And the black community was going to be more receptive to having a dialogue with a black cop than they would be having a dialogue with a white cop. And the sheriff knew that. And so because of that, he temporarily put Oscar Jordan as the head of this case. So the first thing that Oscar knew he had to do was to identify who the victim was. And so he asked the medical examiner before he conducted the autopsy to snap a picture of the victim in hopes that he could take that picture around the community and ask those in the community, did they recognize this person? I've already said that the victim was disfigured. He had been sitting out in the sun for days, but he was just hoping that someone would know something. And it's also unclear if somebody gave him intel to go and check at the People's Choice Club, or if he just did that on his own because it was a popular spot in the black community. But for whatever the reasons were, he did ask people in the community and he didn't get any information. So he did go down to the People's Choice Club. And while he was down there, there was a detective who was a part of the Griffin Police Department. And this particular detective frequented the People's Choice Club. And so he immediately showed this detective the picture. And the detective said to him, he said, I know. Very confidently, he said, I know who this is. This looks like the Coggins boy. And so Jordan knew okay, this detective frequents here a lot. If he's saying this is Timothy Coggins, then I need to go and talk to the Coggins family and see if they're able to affirm that it's their son, brother, uncle. Once again, Timothy's niece is able to give us a good account on what happened the day that Oscar Jordan pays her family a visit, because she's there. And her mother, Timothy Coggins' sister, is there. And she's able to affirm to Oscar Jordan that it is indeed her brother, Timothy Coggins, in the picture. And not only does the family have to wrap their mind around the fact that Timothy Coggins, their brother, their son, their nephew, uncle, has been murdered, but they also have to swallow that very bitter and painful pill that somebody murdered him in such a disrespectful and hateful way. And their mind is completely in a tailspin. So he has the affirmation of the community that it is indeed Timothy Coggins, but he also has the affirmation of Timothy Coggins' family. So they also get the dental records and they affirm once again that it is Timothy Coggins in the photo and at the medical examiner's office. So soon, the medical examiner calls Oscar Jordan and he is able to tell him exactly how Timothy Coggins died. According to the medical examiner, he said that Timothy Coggins' skull had been crushed in. He was stabbed a total of 7 times to the chest. And those stab wounds were in a particular pattern. And initially he said it was in the shape of a cross, but upon further investigation, he said it was actually in the shape of the rebel flag, which is the Confederate flag. And so I want you to tuck that into your back pocket. Now, he said that Timothy Coggins died an excruciating, painful death. He was literally left out there to die. He was not deceased when they left him out there. He was actually alive. And I mentioned that the detectives said that they cut his knee and they cut a tendon in his knee so that he would not be able to run or seek any type of safety or safe haven. And they did that intentionally because they wanted him to die a very painful death. So now that Oscar Jordan knows who it is, he knows exactly how he died, the investigation really begins. And he now has to find out what exactly happened at the People's Choice Club. And according to Talisa, Timothy Coggins' sister, she really is unable to give him really any hard facts. You know, she was told that Timothy was dancing with a white girl. She doesn't know this said white girl's name. And then she was told that 2 white men were looking for him inside of the club. But then he left with these 2 white men. So he has to really tackle down, so to speak, what exactly happened at the People's Choice Club. Because if he can figure out what happened and who he left with, that will really get him on the path to what happened to Timothy Coggins after those events and what may have eventually led to his murder. Oscar Jordan goes back into the community, and those who were attending the People's Choice Club on October 7th to really figure out what happened that night. And according to those who were there, they said that Timothy Coggins was dancing with a white woman that night. However, no one could tell Oscar the woman's name. They were able to dispel the notion that 2 white men came into the club. They said that 2 white men did not come into the club. However, Timothy Coggins at some point did walk outside with said white woman, and that there were two white men across the street. And those two white men called Timothy Coggins across the street, and Timothy Coggins were friendly with them. And at some point, Timothy got into the car with the two white men and said white woman that he was dancing with, and they drove off. And the interaction seemed friendly. It did not seem like Timothy was not friendly with the people that he left with. So for just a brief second, I want to stop here and revisit the culture of Griffin and talk about interracial dating. And I want you to think about it and form your own opinions about it. And eventually, I want you to go to our poll and tell me what you think. Interracial dating in America, specifically as it relates to Black and white people, has always been taboo. I mean, let's face it, it's taboo today. People like Dr. Umar and tons of people on TikTok and social media, period, have their own opinions on interracial dating. I mean, you would think that we have graduated from that, that we have moved on, that we can say freely, one can be with whomever they want. But everybody has their own think pieces about it. And there in Griffin, they had their own opinions on it. And we've already talked about how in Griffin, there were very fine lines in the sand on what races could do and what they could not do. And it was very clear. Now, it was a racist town. There's no doubt about it. But although it was racist, it was normalized. Discrimination was normalized. It was very normal. And Timothy's niece really gave us a, you know, she really lifted the shade on how normal it was there. She actually said that there in Griffin, although it was segregated, that was normal. It was normal to have Black people on one side of the tracks and to have white people on the other side of the tracks. And then, you know, you would just say hi to them every now and then, and you would coexist with white people being on the other side of the track. And every now and then, you know, you would say hi to them. She also said it was completely normal to see Confederate flags waving in the streets. It was completely normal for the Ku Klux Klan to participate in marches in the Christmas parade in Griffin under their crispy white sheets. This was tolerated. Nobody felt like this was abnormal behavior. So everybody participated in it. Even law enforcement. No one thought this was not okay. This was normalized behavior. So when a person like Timothy Coggins dances with a white woman, well, this is more than taboo. This is crossing a line, a very firm, fine line that existed within a town that had things that were normal, things that you just did not do in the town. So it was more than taboo. It was things that you knew there were going to be harsh consequences if you participated in behaviors that just weren't, you just did not do that. Nobody cared that it was 1980. Nobody cared that laws were abolished and things were no longer like that outside of the town. You just did not do that. And if you did, well, there were consequences for that behavior. Now, I'm very interested to hear what you guys think about interracial dating and about this whole issue. But I want to continue about this case. So let's move on. So now we kind of have a little bit more information about what took place. We have a hard factual information about what took place at the People's Choice Club. You know, before it was two white men were looking for Timothy. We didn't know if it was a friendly interaction, but so far we know that it was friendly and he left willingly with these two men and he was most certainly dancing with a white woman. We just don't have names. And he was seen alive for the last time at the People's Choice Club and he left with three white people. And that's what we know. And it was friendly. So now Jordan really has to dig into what was going on with Timothy Coggins in the months and weeks leading up to his horrific murder. And what we find out is, according to his neighbors and friends and family, Timothy was desperately trying to get money. And Jordan was told by friends and family that Timothy and his friend Danny were given $600 by two white males to go and get some weed from them. And those two white men weren't from Griffin. They actually came up from another town. But instead of Danny and Timothy going to get that weed and purchase it and give it to those two white males, they decided they were just going to run off on the plug. They weren't going to go get it. They decided they just were going to get that money and take it. Well, something actually happened. Danny was killed, actually 3 weeks before Timothy was killed. And when Timothy found out that Danny was killed, it spooked him. And those who knew the whole story, friends and family of Timothy, they found out that Danny was killed. Timothy told them that he was spooked. And he said that he had until Thursday to come up with the money to pay those white men back, or something could or would happen. And when Oscar Jordan found out about this information, like, it was an epiphany that went off for him. He just knew that he was really connecting the dots, putting the pieces of the puzzle together. Like, he was investigating. He was like, okay, I got it. So he called his sheriff up and he told his sheriff, listen, like, we might actually have a related homicide, and this might be a revenge killing because of drugs. And that's why it was so horrific and so bad, because Timothy actually owed these two white men money, and maybe that's why he was killed. And so maybe we have two homicides on our hand instead of one, and it's actually related. And so the sheriff was like, okay, like, keep digging, see what else we have here. Maybe that's what it is. Just keep researching. So Jordan felt good about it. He felt like maybe he had something here, but he did exactly what his sheriff shared with him. Well, in the meantime, in between time, Jordan actually received a phone call to go to Carly's trailer park. And according to an informant who reached out to him, a woman by the name of Sandra Pan, it was the white woman, and she had been bragging and boasting about what happened to Timothy Coggins. And it was the things that she was saying specifically that really made Oscar Jordan want to go and talk to her, because he felt like, okay, this is just sounding eerily too close to what actually happened. And according to her, she was saying things like, this nigger hard on that ER, because you know how they do, the racist one. She said this nigger that her and her brother had chained up behind the back of a vehicle in a field, they had killed him, and she was boasting and bragging about it. And so when he heard those particular details, he knew he had to go and confront her. And she had claimed, according to her account, that on the night of Timothy Coggins' murder, her brother, Franklin Gebhardt, along with his girlfriend, Mickey Guy, and their friend, Billy Moore, and Timothy Coggins pile into Moore's truck, and they drove towards the hanging tree. This is information that they had not released to the public. So this is all things that are going off in Oscar Jordan's head as alarm bells. Like, okay, I think we may have our people. Now, Jordan already knew that Tim had taken money from two white males, and this is matching the story about Timothy owing two white males money. So he's kind of putting two and two together. And Franklin and Billy look like they might match these two white males. So he's still listening to everything that she's saying. And she's talking about how they drug him in this truck, and how Franklin, you know, stabbed him. She's giving him all the details about how Timothy was killed. After hearing her account, he knows without a shadow of doubt, he has found his suspects. He is convinced he has found the people who has killed and who was responsible for Timothy Coggins' death. So, of course, he goes to his sheriff and he tells him that he feels that he has solved the case and he wants to bring in Franklin Gebhardt. He wants to at least arrest Sandra and then bring in the others for interviews. But the sheriff says, absolutely not. We need to shut this down. As a matter of fact, you're pulled from this case. Your help and your service is no longer needed. He reassigns Oscar Jordan to traffic duty. He's no longer even a patrol officer. He's reassigned to traffic duty. And then he reassigns the case to a white officer. Jordan is completely confused because he felt like this case could be solved within a matter of days. He had the suspects like literally in his hands and he felt like he was giving them to the sheriff. And so he couldn't understand why the sheriff was not taking the bait and then why the sheriff then demoted him and then gave the case to a white police officer. And the whole point of giving the case to Jordan in the first place was to make sure that the black community felt like they had an ally within the Timothy Coggins case. It just didn't make a whole lot of sense. However, Jordan just decided to go along with what was being done, although he just disagreed with what was taking place. So he handed the case off, told the investigator everything that he had, and he really felt like, okay, even though I'm not going to be the one to solve this case is solvable. Like, I'm literally giving you this case on a silver platter. Solve it. Like, because it's, you can solve this in the next couple of days. I don't care that I'm not the one to solve it. It's cool. Solve it. So the white officer, which they don't tell us his name or else I would be using it, but he goes off and he questions Franklin Gebhardt. And the investigator talks to him and Franklin Gebhardt says, well, I was with my girlfriend at her house the whole night of the murder. And his girlfriend, allegedly, according to Franklin Gebhardt's story, was also with all of them, right? Along with Billy Moore. But they go, the head investigator then goes and talks to Mickey Guy. Mickey Guy backs up his alibi because why would she not? And the head investigator is totally okay with that. He's like, he's good. And he doesn't even take the time to go and question Billy Moore. Now, in the meantime, in between time, the Coggin family is on edge. They don't feel supported by the sheriff department. They are frightened. They're living life on edge because they don't know who is responsible for Timothy's death. And now that Oscar Jordan is off of the case, they don't even feel like they had the ally they once had. And now they're starting to receive threats. Yes, they have people who are driving past their home, throwing bricks into their house with messages being left that says, hush, shut your mouth. If you know what's best for you, you'll be next. And so they're just living life on the edge of their seat. And one thing Timothy Coggins' niece says is that up until the point where her uncle is murdered, she really did have a healthy respect for white people and law enforcement. She never really gave it a second thought. And she didn't have a fear of law enforcement at all. That was until the murder of her uncle. I appreciate the introspection that Timothy Coggins' niece said. And I think it brings about a conversation that deserves our collective attention as we are listening to this episode. Whether you have been personally impacted by discrimination, prejudice, or racial tension, it prompts us to reflect on our own experiences, both direct and indirect, with these issues. So as you engage in this discussion, or as you are listening, I urge you to deeply consider the dynamics at play and the emotions they evoke, rather than interjecting my own opinions, as I often do here on Murder in the Black. I aim to create an environment on this episode today where you can collectively contemplate your attitudes about law enforcement and the historical trajectory of the Black community's relationship with them. This is a conversation that merits our thoughtful engagement and introspection about what we truly think about it and where we are from a historical perspective. Despite receiving death threats, the Coggins family went forward and laid Timothy to rest. And it was just a terrible experience. Their words, not mine. According to his cousin Cynthia, his older sister laid over his casket and with tears in her eyes remarked, "They did not have to take him like this." The family never put a headstone on his grave because they feared retaliation. They feared that someone would come and just mess over his headstone, mess over his grave, and continue to desecrate where they laid him to rest. And so they never put a headstone on his grave. Now, December 26, 1983, 3 months later, the case was closed abruptly, despite not being fully investigated. They never went and talked to Billy Moore. They never fully checked out the alibi of Franklin Gebhardt or Mickey. They just closed the case. And it all seemed very intentional. A cold case paralyzes everybody. It paralyzes the community, whether they know it or not, because the community is left not knowing if someone else in the community could be murdered, if a murderer is out on the loose, if they're going to do that to someone else inside of the community. The family itself is paralyzed. They keep moving on. You keep going forward because you literally kind of have to. But you still, there is still a portion of you that cannot move forward. And so you're forced to go on, but it's literally on autopilot because you're left without answers, but your life somehow is still forever changed. Now, Timothy Coggins' mother, she was left with a broken heart. And quite literally, she had heart problems. And as a result of grief, she ended up passing away. December of 2016, 33 years after the murder, Jared Coleman was assigned to the case of Timothy Coggins, the cold case. And he was the second year GBI investigator. And he was horrified to see how much evidence had not actually been preserved. So he went back through the case file just to kind of see what he had. And he wanted to see what was actually preserved. And there wasn't a whole lot, but he also saw that there wasn't a whole lot of interviews that was conducted back in the 80s with Franklin Gebhardt and Mickey and Billy Moore. So he kind of went back through and he said, okay, I have something here. Let me go back through and comb through some things. So he looked at the interview and the witness statements and he saw that Franklin was kind of bragging to witnesses and people throughout the community that he had killed Timothy. Well, when investigators spoke with Franklin, of course, he said that he had stayed with Mickey all that night, and Mickey was the person that corroborated his alibi. So they did just a quick interview with Mickey, but no follow-up was done. And really, the allegation or the rumor throughout the community was that Timothy Coggins was sleeping with Mickey and they were having an affair. And Franklin found out about this affair and he got angry. And this is kind of what led to them picking up Timothy and taking him out and eventually murdering him in this horrendous way. It all started because of this affair. So equipped with this new information and these new rumors and witness information and witness account, Jared decided that it was time to go and pay Mickey Guy a visit because years had passed and it was time to see if she was actually going to say something different. I mean, sometimes that happens, right? Years pass and people's stories change. Unfortunately, Mickey Guy had passed away. Father Time or the devil got her. Either way, she was no longer here to give her account. So Billy Moore was actually still alive and they decided to press him for more details. But of course, he said he had no knowledge about the murder of Tim Kitchens. So they go and pay Franklin Gebhardt a visit in hopes that he would reveal a little bit more information, if any, about Tim's murder. Well, thankfully, Franklin Gebhardt was already in Spalding County Jail. He was locked up on a sexual assault charge. He was now 59 years old, old man, and he claimed he knew nothing about the murder of Tim. So Jared tries another tactic. He tells him about the current rumor mill about Tim Kitchens and Franklin's then girlfriend, Mickey. He said that there was a rumor that back in 1983, Tim and Mickey were sleeping together, and this is why Tim was murdered. And the calm Franklin Gebhardt, who was super calm when Jared entered the county jail, was now in an uproar. He was angry, and he said, "You trying to tell me that my wife was sleeping with a nigger?" Then he claims that he didn't know Timothy and he didn't care if Timothy was killed, that he should have been minding his own business and he didn't know him. And, you know, he really didn't know Tim, but Tim really should have been minding his business. And it is at this point that Jerry really understands that Franklin has more to do with the murder of Tim than what he initially leads on when he comes into the county lockup. And whether Franklin realizes or not, he has revealed his cards. He couldn't keep his poker face on long enough. But the reality of it is that Jared just does not have enough evidence. This is not enough evidence to convict anybody. And I've already told you that there was not a whole lot of evidence preserved at the crime scene initially. When the detectives back in 1983 went out to the crime scene, there wasn't a lot then. And now that 33 years have expired, well, there's just not a whole lot of evidence now. So Jared really does have the burden of collecting enough evidence to prove his case to the DA that Franklin did indeed or is responsible for the murder of Tim Kitchens, and so is Billy Moore. And so he takes on the task of proving it. So he has to prove it through DNA evidence and some physical evidence. But how does he find out? And how does he go about collecting it? That is the question. Now, Jerry remembers that there was some pants that Kitchens was wearing. You remember, Kitchens was only wearing his underwear and some pants when he was found down by that hanging tree. So he goes back into the case file and he cannot find these pants. And they're missing. And he is just steaming, piping hot because he felt like, okay, this, at least I will have that. And at least I can put that in CODIS and CODIS will kick out something. And that will be exactly what I need. But it wasn't, because they're not there. And so he goes down to Spalding County, and now they have a new sheriff. The old sheriff who initially kicked Oscar Jordan off the case is no longer there. They have a new sheriff in town, and he goes down there to have a discussion with him in hopes of finding those missing pants, so that he can finally put a nail in the coffin, so to speak, to seal this case for the Codgins family. Now, the new sheriff's name is Sheriff Daryl Dix, and he was a part of the culture shift that was happening in Spalding County down there in Griffin, Georgia. And according to Oscar Jordan, you know, he himself said that he felt like there was some corruption within the sheriff department in Spalding County. And he hesitated to say in his interview that he felt like everyone was completely corrupted. But as you will be able to see as I begin to tell you more and more about this, it's okay to call a spade where there is corruption. You have to say corruption exists. And if it's in the leadership, bet you by golly, wow, it's permeating everywhere if it's in leadership. So Sheriff Daryl Dix was a part of the culture shift that was happening in the Spalding County Police Department. And when Oscar Jordan was there, he said it was not unusual to hear white police officers say nigger, to use the word, and to, you know, just be racist within the police department. That was totally normal. But I think that fits in with the normalization that was happening within Griffin, Georgia. So fast forward to April 2017, and Jared is now looking for these pants, okay? And Sheriff Daryl Dix is down there, and he's a part of trying to change the culture of Griffin, especially in the police department as the new sheriff. He's trying to help find these pants. And I'm gonna just tell you, the pants were never found. That's the short answer. But as they were looking for these pants, as they were going through and going through boxes of evidence, looking for these pants down in the evidence locker of the sheriff department, they uncover a black diary. And it went all the way back to the 1980s. And there were officers that were in the Klan. And it exposes that the Klan was infiltrated by the sheriff department, which led to the case being closed. The Timothy Codgins case was closed because the Ku Klux Klan infiltrated the sheriff department. You heard that right. And there was an entry on Wednesday, May 19th, 1982. A deputy Stan asked me if I would join the Klan. Johnny, the owner of the cafe, said, "You are making the best move of your life. It's about time white people stood up for their rights and put a stop to all of this shit." Johnny then stated he had a number of good Klan members in the police and 15 sheriff departments of the same officers would be investigating Tim's murder the following year. And that is a direct quote from that diary. So although they did not find those missing pants, which really would have solved this case like a lot faster, they did find something. They found something that really blew the lid off of Spalding County Police Department. It showed that Timothy Codgins' case wasn't just closed abruptly for no reason. It was closed because the Ku Klux Klan was keeping a lid on Timothy Kogan's case because it was a hate crime. And they were trying to protect their own. That is why. And so when Sheriff Dix found out this information, he could have kept it closed mouth. He could have swept it under the rug. But instead, he told the Kogan's family what they found and what they knew. And of course, the case was reopened. They told the media. And what really came out of this is that a witness came forward from all of this information being exposed. And this witness name was Chris Vaughn. He was mentioned throughout the investigation. Honestly, he wrote to the sheriff's office several times. And he said that he had information about the case, but nobody inside of Spalding County Sheriff's Office never looked into it because they were trying to keep it hush hush, and they abruptly closed the case and they were trying to keep a lid on it. And no one would listen. So he wrote letters in 2004, and it would take the GBI another 3 years to interview him. According to Chris, he was 10 years old when Timothy was murdered, and he lived around Franklin and Billy, and Franklin and Billy bragged about the killing of Timothy. He said that Franklin said that they murdered Timothy because it had something to do with Mickey. And on the night of the murder, they enticed Timothy to get into the car with them by telling him that they were going to party with him, and they had drink and they had drugs, and that's how they got Timothy to come back with them. And they knew that Christopher was telling the truth because Christopher knew things about the murder that no one else would know. Christopher knew about the knife, and the knife was never recovered. That was something that the police, they never recovered a knife. They never recovered a knife. They knew that Timothy had been stabbed. As I told you, he was stabbed in like an upside down cross, like the Confederate flag, but they never recovered a knife. And Christopher was able to tell them where Franklin disposed of that knife. And according to Christopher Vaughn, Franklin disposed of that knife in a well on his property. And so when Christopher gave them that detail, they knew that Christopher was onto something. And so they were like, okay, this sounds believable. So really, they need physical evidence, right? They don't have those pants. They don't have that underwear. So they really need physical evidence. They want that knife. So they have to get a search warrant to go out to Franklin Gebhardt's property and search that well. But that well has been filled in. It's been cemented. And they can go in and actually recover and like pull out things. But they need to get a search warrant, and they need to show that there's a reasonable cause to search the property. So they ask the judge for a search warrant. The judge agrees there's reasonable cause to go and search Franklin Gebhardt's property, that well. So they enlist the help of a company that specialized in shooting high pressure water down a well. And then they use a device that would vacuum back up whatever was down in that well with a tanker. And it was just a whole process that was very interesting, might I add, that they have technology that can do all of those things for you. Because you would think, man, there's no way they could possibly go down in a well that has been dried up, cemented, and push things up that have been sitting there for 33 years. Well, yeah, there's not an app for that, but there most certainly is technology for that. And so they were able to do that. And they pushed up all this gunk that had been sitting up there for past 30 years, right? That had been sitting up there since the well had been dug up, right? So no telling how long that had been. So Sheriff Dix is there. The DA is there. Jared is there. and it takes them all day to excavate the well. They find a shoe, an Adidas shoe, that is recovered. And Sheriff Dix looks at the shoe and you know, they all know what's inside of the case file, right? What has been recovered and what was on Timothy Coggins' feet when he was found and what he was missing and what he wasn't. So when they see this shoe from 1983, they're automatically like, oh my goodness, that definitely looks like that could fit, you know, Timothy Coggins' foot. That doesn't look like that could fit Franklin Gebhardt's foot. It doesn't look like that would be his size. So Timothy Coggins had a sneaker like that. And then they find a handle. They don't find the steak knife, but they find the handle of a steak knife. And the person who locates that is Sheriff Dix. And then they find a piece, just a piece, you guys, a sliver of a piece of a t-shirt, and has several stab marks that match perfectly to Tim's stab wounds. And everybody's minds are blasting with ideas. They know they have them. And Marie, who was the DA, she was out there that day, and she immediately sent the family a message. And she knew that she had enough evidence to go to trial. And so she has enough probable cause to make an arrest. So Sheriff Dix calls Oscar Jordan. He calls Oscar Jordan to come out of retirement to make the arrest. Because quite honestly, Oscar Jordan knew the entire time. He literally handed this over to the first sheriff on a silver platter so that they could close this case back in 1983. But Sheriff Dix knew that the right thing to do was to allow Oscar Jordan to come out of retirement and arrest both Franklin Gebhardt and Billy Moore. And that's exactly what he did. Now, Tim Coggins' family said it was one of the most satisfying calls to receive, that they were, one, finally going to trial, and that an arrest was finally made. But what was also bittersweet was that Timothy's mother was unable to receive the justice or the closure from going to trial and seeing the people who murdered her son being held accountable. So before trial began, after the arrest was made and the DA was really kind of putting all the pieces of her case together, Marie called the family down to show them photos that would be shown in trial. And it was just horrible. But Marie knew she had to prepare them because she knew they would be sitting in the gallery every single day. And this is what she was preparing to show the jurors. And she had to let them see what she was preparing to show others so that she could make sure that they could, you know, secure some type of justice, but they wouldn't be shocked as well. So the DA was more than prepared for trial. The murder of Timothy Coggins was brutal. He had a total of 29 stab wounds. The Confederate flag was engraved in his chest. He was dragged with a pickup truck with a chain. He was left to die alone in that field. They meant for him to suffer. Now, Franklin was tried first. He showed absolutely no emotion. And on June 26, 2018, unanimously, he was found guilty of malice murder, felony murder, and he was sentenced to life plus 30 years. Bill Moore was charged with malice murder and felony murder, but he pled down to manslaughter, and he ended up being sentenced to 20 years in prison. However, he died 3 years into his sentence in October of 2021. After the trial, the Coggins family had a memorial service for Timothy's life and they put a headstone on Timothy's grave. He is gone, but never forgotten. This is the case of Timothy Cotton. Takeaway. This case for me has been intentionally thought-provoking. I hope that I have left you with something that has caused your mind to stir, has caused you to think about law enforcement, our relationship with them as far as the Black community, our relationship with law enforcement historically, and where it stands today. And maybe where you sit with it from a personal standpoint. And then maybe start to think of some solutions, legislation, how that should play out in your role within your own community. You know, here on Murder in the Black, I think that I have intentionally tried to structure our program to be fun, like to have a fun, loving structure, where we sit down and we tell you to grab your coffee. If it's the morning, grab your lemonade and to grab your wine. And we kind of tell you a true crime story that you may or may have not heard. We try to pull from different episodes and different documentaries, and we don't try to hide where we got it, you know, because we want you to go back and look at it, or maybe for you to tell us where you got it from. But there are some episodes that just sit on our spirit, you know, and this happens to be one of those. And within those, I hear some people say, overwhelmingly, you guys leave reviews and you tell us, oh, I love the structure of your show. It feels like I'm just talking to a girlfriend. Just feels like I'm sitting down in the kitchen and my girlfriend's telling me a story. And I love that. And that's why we have personal commentary within our story. And then sometimes I hear some people say, I wish you just hurry up and get to the story. And I can appreciate that. Sometimes this might not be the podcast for you. Let's just keep it a bean, right? But the reality of it is, a episode like this, I try to keep my commentary to a minimum, because I wanted to create the bandwidth for you to think, because this is heavy. African Americans, Black people, we've been told that we're different things here in America. But whatever you choose to call yourself as a Black person here, we have had it very hard with law enforcement. And it makes it hard for us to have a trusting relationship with them, because quite often they play in our faces. And the story of Timothy Cotton's is an exact example that we can point to and say, look at that. And it wasn't too long ago. It's just 1983. And we had a person like Oscar Jordan, who was supposed to be our ally, who was our ally. And they played in his face, which means they played in our face. Timothy Cotton's story could have been solved, but it wasn't. And it infuriates me. Cases like this make me angry. And so I ask you, what do you think about this case? Where does this leave us in a space of true crime where we're trying to make sure our stories are told and we are forced to have to deal with law enforcement and we don't know where to turn? What are we supposed to do when our story, when our case could have been solved within less than a month of the murder happening? I don't know. But these are tough conversations, and I think it should be had within the spaces of each other. We should be able to have these conversations with each other. No better place to have them but here. Right? So, takeaway, not so much. But a conversation for sure. So that is our episode for this week. I want to go ahead and get into our poll from last week. Let's talk about it. Last week's poll question was about the murder of Tory Lanez. And I asked you, did you think Tory's death was accidental? 8% of you said yes, 66% of you said no, and 25% of you said, I don't know. And of course, I'm going to agree with the 66% of you. And the truth is, we really don't know, but let's face it, you cannot believe a liar. So we really can't trust what her friend said. We just can't trust him. So if you have no idea what I'm talking about, check out our episode about Tory Lanez. It is called The Unraveling. I promise it's something you don't want to miss. But this episode was a good one. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Please join us next week. We will be doing another listener's choice. I'm telling y'all, I have a whole spreadsheet that I have created with your names or your Instagram handle and your suggestions. So if you want to get that in, go ahead, keep sending them. I got an Excel spreadsheet, I promise. So send those in. And I'm so excited because next week at the top of the episode, I will be sharing a first responder's questions that I asked them. She got in touch with me. And if you are a 911 dispatcher, please get in touch with me. I have a couple of questions that I want to share with our audience just about what you guys go through. And so we can really kind of let the sun shade up about what you guys go through from our perspective so we can see what happens sometimes in those phone calls. We don't want to get too much into your business because we want you to keep your jobs. Okay, hello. So if you are a 911 dispatcher, get in contact with me. I have a first responder's take. So shout out to T. I will be sharing those next week. But until then, next time, friends, this is Murder in the Black. You know what I'm going to say. I love you. Bye.